In the end, what difference does it make what one candidate or the other did or didn't do during the Vietnam War? In some ways, that war is as distant as the Napoleonic campaigns. What the prominent journalist didn't bother revealing is that at the very time he was saying John Kerry's Vietnam record was irrelevant, he himself was working on a story that would air on a major national television news program just 1 month later about, take a deep breath, George W. Bush and what he did or didn't do during the Vietnam War. If you haven't guessed, the prominent journalist was Dan Rather. So how is it that when John Kerry was taking fire from his critics, Dan thought Vietnam was irrelevant, but just 1 month later, when George Bush was in the crosshairs, Vietnam was as relevant as could be? Could it be that Dan Rather was taking sides, that he was recklessly using his substantial power to further a liberal Democrat's cause at the expense of a conservative Republican? Nah. Just ask Dan Rather, who, whenever he's been questioned over the years about liberal bias, has always given the same answer. I'm in favor of a strong defense, tight money, and clean water. I don't know what that makes me, but whatever that makes me, that's what I am. With all due respect, what that makes you, Dan, is disingenuous at best and delusional at worst. Does anyone really believe that Rather would have run with the dubious documents if he got them from an unimpeachable conservative source who was out to get John Kerry? There's not much point in rehashing the whole sordid affair, but even if we choose to be generous and conclude that Dan Rather was nothing more than the innocent dupe of an overzealous producer who may have had her own political agenda, he is still accountable for his key role in the shameful cover-up. And let's be fair, this isn't Dan's problem alone. When Rather first came under fire, the two other network anchors came galloping to his defense. One of them, Tom Brokaw, decried the kind of political jihad against Rather as highly outrageous. We have come to expect members of the club to stick together in times of crisis. Clan rules require such loyalty. But no, Tom, it's not a political jihad against Dan Rather to raise legitimate questions about why he got taken by such obviously phony documents just 55 days before the election, or about why he thought Vietnam was so unimportant when the charges were aimed at a Democrat, and why he thought they were so important when they were aimed at a Republican. This is both their bias and their arrogance. And in the end, with all the new media out there, it may also be their downfall. If Dan Rather and the others think they can continue to dismiss legitimate criticism of their motives, they're dead wrong. Yes, as many have pointed out, Dan has had a distinguished career, covering every major story since the assassination of JFK. He has shown tremendous courage in going to some very dangerous places to get the news, and he's interviewed some of the most important people in the world. And all of this will be part of his legacy. But so will Rather's dark side, his stubborn unwillingness to take serious criticism seriously. In Dan's world, it's always those vicious, nasty, partisan political forces that are out to get him. What are the chances, now that the reputation of CBS News is in shreds, that he will take a long, hard look inward, not just at myopic zeal and where it can lead, but at his own biases and those of his colleagues and where they so often have led? As Dan himself might put it, take a hard look at ourselves, respect our critics. Boy, you got a better chance of slow dancing with a porcupine at Buckingham Palace during a lunar eclipse and liking it. 11. Noam Chomsky. There's a chance that you've never heard of Noam Chomsky, unless, of course, you hang out on college campuses in places like Berkeley or Palo Alto or Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Chomsky is as big as Elvis was in Las Vegas. Maybe bigger. In fact, the New York Times has called him, arguably, the most important intellectual alive. The Chicago Tribune says Chomsky is cited more than any other living author and shows up eighth on the all-time most cited list, right after Sigmund Freud. He's also a hit in France and Germany, where his ideas, which are spread through his many books and countless speeches and interviews, are especially highly regarded. Okay, Noam Chomsky is a very big deal in certain places. So, why is he on the list? Because in many ways, he's the epitome of what, in a sane world, would be a complete contradiction in terms, the anti-American, American intellectual. Here's a man who has prospered in America beyond all reason, yet looking at his country, Chomsky sees ugliness, greed, and moral corruption. This is a guy who apologizes for the world's most bloodthirsty dictators and then, without blinking, calls the United States a leading terrorist state. Noam Chomsky made his name long ago in academic circles for his work on linguistics at MIT, but he achieved true superstar status not for that, but for his relentless, vicious attacks on all things American. American society, American values, American behavior in the world. So, what exactly is Chomsky's message? It is that America, way more often than not, is wrong, small-minded, petty, and venal. When you come back from the Third World to the West, the U.S. in particular, as he once put it, you are struck by the narrowing of thought and understanding, the limited nature of legitimate discussion, the separation of people from each other. Chomsky is always happy to come out against tyranny and brutality, and for him that will always mean, first and foremost, the United States of America. In fact, nothing in his long career was quite so nauseating as his analysis of 9/11. No one was so quick to rationalize the terrorist attack that killed thousands in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania by calling attention to the far more extreme terrorism, as he put it, that is the United States foreign policy. Sound familiar? It's not for nothing Michael Moore has been referred to as Chomsky for children. But as with Moore, it's a lot harder to laugh when you consider the consequences of Chomsky's behavior. In the words of the conservative social critic David Horowitz, the most devious, the most dishonest, and in this hour of his nation's grave crisis, the most treacherous intellect in America belongs to MIT professor Noam Chomsky. 10. Ralph Nees. If you just went by its name, you'd think that People for the American Way was one of those organizations involved only in selfless good deeds like the March of Dimes or the Boy Scouts. Oops, hold on, you can't say that. Selfless good deeds and Boy Scouts in the same breath anymore. Not since those despicable Scouts became a target of liberal groups for their supposed anti-gay bigotry and their unapologetic belief in God. Which brings us right back to the People for the American Way and its aggressive, self-righteous guiding spirit, Ralph Nees. It will come as no surprise to anyone familiar with Nees's career that the Boy Scouts have been on his hit list, part of a long hit list of organizations and individuals with a conservative orientation he has sought to demonize and, in some cases, destroy. Ralph Nees, you see, is one powerful guy who wields tremendous influence in the halls of Congress. He's got the clout to mobilize all sorts of liberal interest groups, which then go out and hammer just about anyone who fails their liberal litmus tests. Of course, there's a place for lobbyists in the legislative process. They represent points of view that need to be heard. But Nees's tactics, his calculated disregard for basic fairness, have served only to stink up the process. Over the years, Nees has famously gone after two nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court, Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas, viciously attacking both of them. But Nees reached a new low in his 2002-2003 campaign to derail the appointment of a U.S. district judge named Charles Pickering, who had been nominated to serve on the U.S. Court of Appeals. Pickering is not merely a decent man, but an exceptionally principled and brave one, a white Mississippian who, after the state's public schools were ordered desegregated, broke with his neighbors to send his children to the local school with black kids and subsequently, at great risk to his own life, testified in court against one of the most violent racists in the state. but none of that mattered, because he's a conservative. Pickering had been a judge for about 40 years, and by most accounts he had a distinguished career. Not distinguished enough, though, for Ralph Neese and his cronies, who went through Pickering's record case by case and came up with a real juicy one. One involving three white bigots who burned a cross on the lawn of a mixed-race couple. Pickering had sentenced one of the young men, a 20-year-old, to 2 years and 3 months in prison, instead of the 7.5 years that had been recommended by the Clinton Justice Department. Pickering said it was a fair sentence because it was the man's first offense, and also because the other two defendants, including the 17-year-old ringleader, had already plea bargained their way to complete and total freedom, no prison time at all. The man standing before Judge Pickering in his courtroom wasn't so lucky. "You're going to the penitentiary for what you did," Pickering lectured the man at his sentencing. "We've got to learn to live races among each other, and the type of conduct you exhibited cannot and will not be tolerated." This wasn't good enough for Ralph Neese. His coddling of a crossburner made Pickering unfit to serve on the Court of Appeals, which, after all, is just one level below the Supreme Court of the United States. This is despite the fact that longtime civil rights activist Charles Evers praised the judge as the man who helped us break the Ku Klux Klan. When a frustrated President Bush bypassed the confirmation process and granted Pickering a temporary recess appointment, Neese's reaction was as ugly as everything that had come before. "Announcing this appointment as Americans prepare to celebrate the birthday of Martin Luther King is an insult to his memory and to all Americans who are committed to equal justice under the law," Neese said. If, as the saying goes, you can know someone from his enemies, there are also times when you know them even better from their friends. Senator Edward Kennedy, one of his closest allies, called Neese the 101st Senator for Civil Rights. In December 2004, Judge Pickering decided he had had enough. He gave up his temporary appointment to the U.S. Court of Appeals and announced his retirement from the bench. 9. Jonathan Kozel. Not long ago, a young man named Dan Gelertner wrote a piece for the Weekly Standard about what it felt like to be a conservative in his upscale, overwhelmingly liberal public high school in Connecticut. "The teachers are predictable liberals," he wrote, "but the students are more worrying." He told about lunchtime at school with his friends, where politics is often on the menu. "Most lunch table liberals say they do not love America," he wrote, "and would not defend it. One boy says he'd just as soon live in Canada. They can't understand why I should be so enthusiastic about our country." While he was writing the piece, a close friend asked what it was about. "To put it briefly," Gelertner writes, "I said, it's about kids who don't love their country." To which his friend replied, "Do they have to love their country? Is that a requirement?" Not that Gelertner was surprised. This is fairly typical stuff coming from the hip, smart kids in well-to-do liberal suburbs these days. Try telling one of them that you get goosebumps when you hear "God Bless America," and he'll think you're hopelessly uncool at best, maybe even a borderline fascist. Why? Because in Dan Gelertner's school, as in many others around the country, teachers trash America and its values as a matter of course. As computer geeks used to say, Gelertner writes, "Garbage in, garbage out." There are any number of ways American education has broken down over the years. Far too many of today's schools are violent, and far too many are filled with kids who don't care much about learning. Yet, what may be even worse, and in the end even more dangerous, is that so many of today's schools are turning out smart kids with little understanding of how precious their heritage is. How did it happen? It's a complicated question, but an excellent place to start is with one man who, despite his considerable popularity in some circles, you may not know. His name is Jonathan Kozel. Kozel is the patron saint of today's powerful liberal educational establishment. For decades on the lecture circuit, in the press, and in books with heart-wrenching titles like Death at an Early Age and Savage Inequalities, which focused mainly on poor and minority kids, He has preached his version of how kids should be educated, and his influence today is immense. Kozol is a fierce opponent of traditional learning, which he says deadens children's souls. He believes that education cannot and should not be politically neutral. Indeed, the once outrageous idea that teachers should use their classrooms to espouse liberal, radical political views, that is, to propagandize, can be traced directly to Jonathan Kozol. His views on the subject are laid out in his influential book On Being a Teacher, which was written following a visit to Cuba in the mid-70s. As conservative education writer Sol Stern put it in the City Journal, Kozol brooded over the ideas he'd taken away from Cuba and molded them into a new theory for reforming American education, taking as a starting point the crude Marxist view that education in all societies is a system of indoctrination, an instrument of the state. He worked out a method by which teachers could subvert capitalist America's bad indoctrination and cleverly and subtly substitute some good left-wing indoctrination in its place, Stern wrote. A typical chapter in On Being a Teacher is called Disobedience Instruction, about how important it is for students to have skepticism of authority. Kozol writes about those ordinary but pathetic figures who went into Watergate to steal, and the ones who went into My Lai to kill, among other reasons because they lacked the power to say no. He says teachers should talk to their students about the architect of the Holocaust, Adolf Eichmann, whose own preparation for obedient behavior, Kozol says, was received in German public schools, which produced good Germans, or good citizens, as we in the United States would say. What's so alarming is that because Jonathan Kozol is so admired in the education establishment, his ideas are put into practice every day in classrooms all across America, from high school all the way down to preschool. As young Dan Gelertner asks, what will become of a country whose youngest citizens have been taught to have so little affection for it? 8. Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman of the New York Times is often described as the most influential liberal columnist in America. I'm not sure if that speaks worse of the New York Times or of today's version of liberalism. For the record, it's not Krugman's left-wing political opinions that are so offensive, although they are pretty offensive, but the nasty way he expresses them and his stubborn refusal to credit his foes with anything resembling decency or principle. From his lofty perch at the Times, on the page that, within recent memory, was home to thoughtful, reasonable, liberal voices like Tom Wicker and James Reston, Krugman cheapens the national debate by hyperventilating twice a week about the lies and manifold other deceits of the Bush administration. When he started in 2000, even the Times couldn't know what it was getting. Since Krugman, after all, is an economist, he was expected to write mainly about, well, economics. And while he's done plenty of that, ripping the Bush tax cut, slamming Bush's desire to privatize a small part of Social Security, and making lots of hopeful predictions, most of them wrong, about how under the Republicans the economy was about to tank, economics is only part of his larger obsession, which is the radical right and how it is leading us into a dark age of repression. This delusion, which has made him a superstar on the left, seems to occupy his every conscious moment, and he can't understand why everyone else doesn't share it. "We need above all sunlight," he told the website Media Channel in the summer of 2004. "We need to see what is actually going on. When are people going to wake up?" he asked. He even goes after the mainstream media, regularly lashing out at journalists for, and I'm not making this up, being lapdogs of the right, and for failing to sound the alarm about how dreadful things are in this country under George W. Bush. Reading his stuff, there are more than a few sensible people who fear he's already gone off the deep end. A former classmate of Krugman's at MIT, an economist named Arnold Kling, wrote a rather touching open letter to his old friend, begging him to get a grip and start using his power a bit more judiciously. we can have a constructive discussion on such matters as tax policy or Iraq or school vouchers, Kling wrote. You have to feel sorry for Kling because trying to reason with Paul Krugman is like trying to reason with a taco. And besides, why should Krugman listen to anybody, given that he already knows that he's right about everything? Meaning what? Well, as he told the German magazine Der Spiegel, I now find myself, once again, the lonely voice for truth in a sea of corruption. Sometimes I think that one of these days I'll end up in one of those cages on Guantanamo Bay, but I can still seek asylum in Germany. I hope you'd accept me in an emergency. Just between us, Mr. Lonely Voice for Truth in a Sea of Corruption, things being as bad as they are here in the United States, why wait for an emergency? 7. Margaret Marshall. If you were looking to find a single person who sums up the most annoying attitudes of the liberal elites, their insularity, their sense of moral superiority, and mostly their smug certainty that they're a lot smarter than the rest of us, you couldn't do much better than Margaret Marshall. Educated at Harvard, where she later served as general counsel and vice president, and Yale, where she's now a trustee, Marshall, who's married to the ultra-liberal former New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, is almost a parody of the liberal intellectual. As the Associated Press observes, she has been an activist her whole life, defines herself by it. She is just passionately committed to the idea that second-class citizens and a permanent underclass is not only cruel to the people who find themselves at the bottom, adds her friend Lawrence Tribe of the Harvard Law School, but degrading and dehumanizing to those who happen to be at the top. Oh, I almost forgot. Margaret Marshall is Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, in which capacity she authored the bombshell 4-3 decision legalizing gay marriage. This makes her a very important person indeed, because while this was a close ruling in only one state, it was a decision with far-flung implications. What happens, for instance, if a gay couple married in Massachusetts moves to Georgia? Is the marriage also legal there? Does a gay marriage in Massachusetts have to be honored in any other state under the U.S. Constitution's full faith and credit clause? Is it reasonable for just 4 judges in one state to cause so much uncertainty in the rest of the country? As the Washington Times notes, in its amazing arrogance and complete indifference to the popular will, the ruling called to mind Clinton crony Paul Begala's infamous 1998 line about presidential executive orders, stroke of the pen, law of the land. Kinda cool. Opponents pointed out that Marshall should not have even ruled on the case in the first place, since her biases on the subject were not exactly a secret. She had even gone so far as to give a speech in May 1999 to the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Bar Association, suggesting legal strategies to challenge existing law. But to Marshall, poster child for judicial activism run amok, mere appearances mattered a lot less than changing the world according to her own views about right and wrong. As for my own take on the subject, when it comes to marriage, frankly, I don't care if Adam marries Eve or Steve. But unlike the over-the-top activist judges, I also respect the views of those tens of millions of Americans whose value system and religious convictions lead them to hold exactly the opposite view. The fact is, it takes someone totally blind to the realities of America, someone like a left-wing ideologue, to simply dismiss those who oppose gay marriage as narrow-minded bigots. Ironically, one unintended consequence of what Margaret Marshall and her colleagues wrought is how badly, so far, their decision on gay marriage has backfired. In November 2004, anti-gay marriage propositions won in all 11 states where they were on the ballot, with broad public support. And speaking of unintended consequences, they may actually have helped President Bush win re-election. This is what happens when you use judges and courts to undermine the democratic process. The way to change the system is to persuade your fellow citizens, not bully them. 6. Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter has been involved for a long time with Habitat for Humanity, building homes for underprivileged people and urging others to do the same. For this, he deserves enormous praise. Now let's get to everything else Jimmy Carter has done. Never mind the good notices he gets in the mainstream press. Never mind even the Nobel Peace Prize he won in 2002, after years of campaigning for it. A good case can be made that Jimmy Carter has done even more damage since he left the White House than he did in it. And that's mainly because, in his role as world citizen, he has regularly lent critical support to regimes that have no use for democratic values and even less for the United States. He's even made a habit of ignoring the crimes of many of these regimes against their own citizens. The ex-president is known as Joe Human Rights, as National Review Online's Jay Nordlinger puts it, but he's mighty selective about whose human rights to champion. If you live in Marcos's Philippines, Pinochet's Chile, or apartheid South Africa, he's liable to care about you. If you live in communist China, communist Cuba, communist Ethiopia, communist Nicaragua, communist North Korea, communist... screw you, is how Nordlinger put it. So whom has Carter given a free pass? Well, there was Romania's brutal communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu, who was executed by his own people, who Carter once proclaimed believed in enhancing human rights. There was Syria's dictator Hafez al-Assad and Haiti's dictator Raul Cedras. There was even North Korea's great leader Kim Il-sung. Then, of course, there are those of our neighbors to the south for whom Carter has long and special affection. Former head Sandinista Daniel Ortega, and the ever-popular Fidel Castro. And whom has Carter gone after with special zeal? Number one on his hit list is Israel. Long lavish in his praise of Yasser Arafat, Carter told his biographer, Douglas Brinkley, that the Palestinian uprising known as the Intifada exposed the injustice Palestinians suffered, just like Bull Connor's mad dogs in Birmingham. The United States will survive Jimmy Carter. Some of the countries where he's pitched in to help straighten things out may not be so lucky. Take Venezuela. In August 2004, Carter helped monitor the vote to recall anti-American, pro-Castro president Hugo Chavez. When Chavez's government declared he had received 58% of the vote, contradicting exit polls showing him losing by 17 points, it seemed clear the fix was in. The next day, when demonstrators peacefully assembled to protest the results and demand a recount, they were attacked by rifle-bearing Chavez supporters. Later that morning, the son of a woman shot down in the demonstration wrote in the Wall Street Journal, the most important election observer, former President Jimmy Carter, declared that he was shown the computer tally by government supporters and that everything seemed in order. Mr. Carter then left. Just a month later, in September 2004, during the run-up to the U.S. presidential election, Jimmy Carter, ever on the lookout for election fraud, said that Florida lacks some basic international requirements for a fair election, and that the disturbing fact is that a repetition of the problems of 2000 now seems likely, even as many other nations are conducting elections that are internationally certified to be transparent, honest, and fair. Let's see if I have this right. The presidential election in Venezuela was on the up and up, according to Jimmy Carter, but the one then upcoming in the United States of America in 2004 was in danger of being rigged. Sounds like he may be ready to put in for another Peace Prize. 5. Anthony Romero. I've never been a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union, but for many years, I liked what the organization was doing. I'm with the ACLU when it musters the courage, as it occasionally does, to speak up for college kids who get in trouble with the speech police for saying something that offends the hypersensitive on campus, something about race or sex or gay rights. And even though I'm personally for the death penalty, I even like the fact that the ACLU fought against it, arguing that amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. That kind of lively debate is good for our democracy. So let's be fair. Over the years, the ACLU has done a lot of good. But let's also face facts. It's also done a great deal of bad, particularly in recent years. Things that are deeply offensive not only to ordinary Americans, but also to common sense and common decency. Like what? The ACLU sued the Boy Scouts of America and got them kicked out of a city park in San Diego, where they had camped out for decades on the grounds that it was a religious organization. The ACLU has argued that even a moment of silence in public schools can amount to the establishment of religion and is therefore unconstitutional. The ACLU has argued that a doctor should not be allowed to tell a wife that her husband has the AIDS virus because the benefits of confidentiality outweigh the possibility that someone may be injured, as an ACLU spokesman explained it. And now we have the ACLU, in all its high-mindedness, aggressively taking on the most urgent issue of our time, the war on terrorism. Thanks in large part to its national director, Anthony Romero, a soft-spoken, obviously intelligent man who took over just before September 11, 2001, in the nearly 3 years since the mass murder of 3,000 innocent people on American soil by fanatical Muslim terrorists, there is not a single law or policy that the ACLU has supported that would help prevent a bloody repeat of September 11th, as Michelle Malkin pointed out in her syndicated column on July 28, 2004. Indeed, thanks to Romero, the ACLU has become an organization that maintains dangerously absolutist positions, as Malkin put it, on all sorts of measures aimed at fighting terrorism. Under Romero, who certainly means well, nothing is quite perfect enough for the ACLU. In fact, in late 2004, the ACLU flat-out rejected over $1 million from the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations because the money came with anti-terrorism strings attached. It seems that, like every other organization the foundation support, the ACLU would have to sign a piece of paper that says, "By signing this grant letter, you agree that your organization will not promote or engage in violence, terrorism, bigotry, or the destruction of any state, nor will it make subgrants to any entity that engages in these activities." Pretty basic stuff, right? Well, no, not to the ACLU. What do they mean by terrorism, Romero wanted to know. What constitutes support for terrorism? So what does the ACLU see as its job during this extraordinarily dangerous period in our history? As Anthony Romero himself says, it is to defend ourselves against John Ashcroft, who has since resigned as Attorney General, and a government that tramples on the Constitution in the name of national security. Well, here's a bulletin, Mr. Romero. The ACLU doesn't have a monopoly on virtue. Most Americans are decent people who care about civil liberties, too. It's just that most of us understand that in times like these, when Muslim fundamentalists want to kill us and our children, honest mistakes might be made from time to time. Sure, at some point, the FBI may ask a librarian for information on what some suspected terrorist was reading. Maybe the suspect will be an Arab, and maybe some Arab organization will cry discrimination. Sorry, it's a small price to pay for living in a free country that happens to be at war. I'm not a lawyer, but I get it. We all get it. If the government is allowed to trample on the rights of any one of us, then none of us is safe from government tyranny. To which I say, bullshit. We live in a different world than we did on September 10th, 2001, and it would help if everyone, starting with Anthony Romero and the ACLU, would be a little more understanding, a little more flexible, a little less absolutist. Right now, the number one civil right most Americans care about is the one about our ass not getting blown up by some lunatic who thinks he's doing it for Allah. We'll worry about who's looking over our shoulder at the library when things calm down. 4. Jesse Jackson. When I was in high school and college in the 60s, the issue that galvanized the nation more than any other, even more than Vietnam, was civil rights. In the 70s, as a correspondent with CBS News, I covered the tail end of the civil rights movement. Along the way, I met wonderful, courageous people like John Lewis, who was one of the leaders of the historic 1965 march from Selma to Montgomery, a man who was brutally beaten by Alabama state troopers as he and thousands of others came across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Today, he's a United States congressman. I met Daddy King, Martin Luther King's father, and covered stories at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where his son had preached. I listened as the parishioner sang, "We Shall Overcome," and was moved, literally, beyond words. And then Martin Luther King was gunned down, and somehow Jesse Jackson became the most prominent voice of Black America. And that's when a movement infused with nobility began to lose not only its luster, but its moral authority as well. That's when the great civil rights movement that made America a better place devolved into something else entirely, eventually something partisan, nasty, and divisive. Looking back, there are a number of reasons for this, but a lot of it has to do with the leadership, or lack thereof, of Jesse Jackson. Like Marlon Brando's character in On the Waterfront, Jesse could have been a contender. He could have been a champion, a worthy successor to Martin Luther King. Instead, he became the Black leader who, choosing to downplay the significant progress in racial relations in this country, endlessly plays the blame game, pointing to conservatives, Republicans, rich people, business types, and the like for all sorts of perceived wrongs. And who, in the eyes of many, and not all of them conservatives, has used his status and power to shake down corporate America with not-so-veiled threats of boycotts for the benefit of minorities who also happen to be close to Jesse Jackson personally. In Jesse's world, yesterday's racist corporation is today's big donor to the Reverend Jackson's coffers. While Jesse Jackson has always denied this charge, there is no question that he was a key figure in changing the entire tone of the movement, where Martin Luther King reached out and appealed to the decency in all of us. Jesse Jackson instead gives us provocative sound bites designed to draw the cameras his way. During the Florida election mess of 2000, Jackson was at it again, saying George W. Bush would preside but not govern because he took this election by Nazi tactics. Booker T. Washington, the great Black educator who devoted his life to bringing free Black people into the mainstream of American life, once said, "There is a class of colored people who make a business of keeping the troubles, the wrongs, and the hardships of the Negro race before the public. Having learned that they are able to make a living out of their troubles, they have grown into the settled habit of advertising their wrongs, partly because they want sympathy and partly because it pays. Some of these people do not want the Negro to lose his grievances because they do not want to lose their jobs." He could have been talking about Jesse Jackson. 3. Ted Kennedy. A man of conscience has to do what a man of conscience has to do. And as everyone knows, the unofficial conscience of the Democratic Party is Ted Kennedy. Of course, given his past, there is something amusing and even perverse about calling Ted Kennedy the conscience of anything. Can you say Chappaquiddick? Or before that, Harvard cheating scandal, when the young Teddy got another, presumably smarter student, to take his Spanish exam for him? And then there's the well-deserved reputation as a big-time drinker and world-class skirt chaser. Okay, you say, but all that happened a long time ago. And anyway, it's what he's done inside the United States Senate that makes him the conscience of the Democratic Party. Fair enough. So let's take a look at that Edward Kennedy, the one who doesn't simply speak, but intones, and when the stakes are high, intones with great moral authority. Let's look at that conscience of the Democratic Party. Here's a Kennedy sampler, a highlight reel of some of his greatest hits, beginning in 1988 with his hit on Judge Robert Bork. Judge Bork, you'll recall, was up for a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court when a morally indignant Senator Kennedy said that if Judge Bork were on the high court, America would be a place where women would be forced into back-alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, and rogue police would break down citizens' doors. A few years later, in 1991, Senator Kennedy tried to bork another nominee to the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas. This time, it didn't work, even though Kennedy gave it his best shot, mustering his usual moral authority as he again tried to destroy a man whose real crime was not simply that he was a conservative, which would have been more than enough for Kennedy to tear him down, but that he was a black conservative, an unforgivable sin in liberal circles. I wonder, in this day and age, whether women are prepared to sit still while the United States puts Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court of the United States, Kennedy said, portraying the nominee as the kind of monster who makes women afraid to show up at the office, the kind of man who fills every workday with anxiety, as he put it, about when the next offensive action and the next embarrassing incident will occur. Can you imagine if a conservative had said the same thing about a black liberal up for a seat on the Supreme Court? But a man of conscience has to do what a man of conscience has to do. The latest highlight on the Kennedy reel, of course, involves George W. Bush and Iraq. In September 2003, the senator was claiming that the Iraq War was a fraud made up in Texas to give Republicans a political boost. This is pretty serious stuff, charging that the president of the United States went to war in order to win re-election. And exactly how would that work? Let's see. President Bush takes the nation to war, an enormously risky political proposition, says the reason we're going to war is that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, even though the president knows the weapons don't really exist, and that sooner or later, certainly before the election, everyone will know they don't exist, and he does this to give Republicans a political boost? Am I missing something? Then, 3 months later, in December 2003, Senator Kennedy, again claiming the high moral ground, says that President Bush's Iraq policy is enough to make the Statue of Liberty weep. I doubt that the women and girls who were raped during Saddam's reign of terror would agree with the man of conscience about that. I'm not sure the Kurds who got gassed by Saddam would agree either, or the families of the 300,000 or so dead people found in unmarked mass graves in Saddam's Iraq. But what do any of them know? They're not the conscience of anything. On May 10, 2004, Kennedy struck again, using the same modus operandi, vicious partisanship masquerading as moral indignation. Even before the facts were in on Abu Ghraib, Kennedy took to the floor of the Senate and said, on March 19, 2004, President Bush asked, who would prefer that Saddam's torture chambers still be open? Shamefully, we now learn that Saddam's torture chambers reopened under new management, U.S. management, Kennedy said. Taken together, this long history of partisan vituperation tells a story of who this liberal lion, Ted Kennedy, really is. When on the attack, as he so often is, Ted Kennedy is a distillery of meanness, in William F. Buckley's perfect description. Then again, as Senator Kennedy and his supporters will tell you, these are dangerous times, and a man of conscience has to do what a man of conscience has to do. 2. Arthur Sulzberger. There's a famous old story about Arthur Pinch Sulzberger Jr., publisher of the New York Times, but for anyone concerned about the state of journalism in this country, it bears repeating. Often. It seems that back in the 60s, when young Pinch was such a committed student activist against the war in Vietnam that he was twice arrested in anti-war protests, his exasperated father, then Times publisher Arthur Sr., asked him a simple question. If a young American soldier comes upon a young North Vietnamese soldier, which one do you want to see get shot? Pinch didn't even hesitate. It was, he said, the dumbest question I ever heard in my life, adding, I would want to see the American get shot. It's the other guy's country. What's important about this is not that, as a very young man in a very turbulent time, he held such views. So did a lot of others, who now look upon much of what they believed in their younger years with at least a twinge of embarrassment. No, what's important and shocking is that Sulzberger told the story himself recently to a pair of sympathetic journalists without even a hint of embarrassment. On the basis of everything he says and does, Sulzberger seems to believe more than ever that he has all the answers, and that those on the left are by definition the good guys, and those on the right, the bad ones. And as the man in charge of the nation's most powerful and influential newspaper, the one from which almost all the other major news outlets, including the networks, slavishly take their cues, he has probably done more than anyone to destroy the confidence of millions of ordinary Americans in the fairness and basic integrity of the so-called mainstream media. The Times has always been a liberal newspaper. That's not the issue. In fact, until recently, it enjoyed the respect of all sorts of people, even those who strongly disagreed with its editorial views, because it admirably fulfilled its basic mission. In the words of the founder of the Times dynasty, Pinch's great-grandfather, Adolf S. Ox, to give the news impartially, without fear or favor, regardless of any party, sect, or interest involved. Pinch himself quoted those words on January 17, 1992, when he took over as publisher from his father. He then proceeded to make a mockery of them. Since he's taken over, despite the paper's claim to journalistic statesmanship, a chief principle at the Times has been its dedication to cheap partisanship, even when it comes at the expense of its own credibility. Here's an example provided by the Weekly Standard, an editorial about Senate filibusters that ran in the Times on January 1, 1995, 3 years into Sulzberger's reign as publisher. In the last session of Congress, the Republican minority invoked an endless string of filibusters to frustrate the will of the majority. This relentless abuse of a time-honored Senate tradition so disgusted Senator Tom Harkin, a Democrat from Iowa, that he is now willing to forego easy retribution and drastically limit the filibuster. Hooray for him! Once a rarely used tactic reserved for issues on which senators held passionate views, the filibuster has become the tool of the sore loser, an archaic rule that frustrates democracy and serves no useful purpose. So said the New York Times. Yes, it's an editorial. The Times has every right to its opinion. Okay, so now consider this second editorial, which was in the paper on March 6, 2005, on the very same subject. The Republicans are claiming that 51 votes should be enough to win confirmation of the White House's judicial nominees, the Times said. This flies in the face of Senate history. To block nominees, the Democrats' weapon of choice has been the filibuster, a time-honored Senate procedure that prevents a bare majority of senators from running roughshod. The Bush administration likes to call itself conservative, but there is nothing conservative about endangering one of the great institutions of American democracy, the United States Senate, for the sake of an ideological crusade, the Times said. This is so much par for the course at today's New York Times that the Weekly Standard ran those two editorials under the headline, Obligatory New York Times Hypocrisy Item. Over Sulzberger's reign at the pinnacle of the Times masthead, he has had four top editors. The paper truly hit rock bottom with a third of these, Pinch's ideological soulmate, Howell Raines, a mean-spirited bully. Raines' enthusiasm for using the Times' news page to aggressively push his own ideological crusades, from racial preferences to gay marriage to even something so petty as getting women into the Augusta National Golf Club, was matched by a management style that turned much of the newsroom against him. When the paper was rocked by the Jason Blair scandal, it was this last jolt that ensured Raines' departure. Since Raines left, under the more moderate Bill Keller, there have been some improvements, notably the hiring of a public editor who has often been sympathetic to reader complaints, including those from conservatives about the paper's more outrageous examples of bias. However cosmetic, the changes are welcome. Still, the paper is a far cry from what it once was, and will surely remain so as long as Pinch Sulzberger is in place, because while editors come and go, he is the constant, the Times version of a permanent government, and he remains unapologetically dedicated to using the paper's influence to impose his notion of the way America ought to be on the rest of us. Number one. On this issue, I have just two words. Michael Moore. And now, a final word. For too many years now, the cultural elites have been working overtime, trying to portray all those hicks in flyover country as grotesquely distorted funhouse mirror images of who they really are, without the fun part. If middle Americans oppose gay marriage, they must be homophobes. If they don't like the sex jokes at 8 o'clock at night on network TV, they're squares. If ordinary Americans think gangster rap is foul and degrading, they're racists who don't understand black culture. If Red State America thinks our best universities are dominated by left-wing ideologues, they're anti-intellectual dolts. If they think feminists have gone too far, they're sexists. But none of this tells us very much about real, ordinary Americans. What it tells us a lot about, though, are the cultural elites themselves, those cloistered liberals who, as Tom Wolfe once put it, do not have a clue about the rest of the United States, and who are forever trying to force their twisted sense of morality onto us, which is a non-morality. That is constantly done, and there is real resentment, Tom Wolfe said. Yes. There is real resentment, indeed. Middle Americans resent the smug condescension the elites routinely dish out from their cocoons in Manhattan and Hollywood. They resent the authors and journalists who call them ignorant because they don't see things the way the elites do. They resent the elites snickering at them because they like to bowl and eat at Red Lobster. They resent the notion that because they go to church every week and take the Bible seriously, that there's something creepy about them. And that because they fly the American flag on the 4th of July, they're simple-minded hayseeds. And it's precisely because of this snobby elitist attitude that even when I agree with liberals on this issue or that, I don't like being associated with them. I'm with Tom Wolfe, who said, "There is something in me that particularly wants it registered that I am not one of them." So, what is it that so many ordinary Americans want? It's actually pretty simple. We want a little more appreciation for the values that most of us, liberals as well as conservatives, Democrats as well as Republicans, used to take for granted. Civility, mutual respect, a semblance of decency, and yes, a little old-fashioned love of country too. Is that asking too much?
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.